Hello and welcome to season 5 of Canine Hoopers World, the podcast. Enjoy. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Canine Hoopers World, the podcast. Today we have a new guest on. I've known this trainer quite a while, but she is part of the Thursday training crew that you heard all about on my episode with Diane last week. So, Helen, how are you?
I'm really well, thanks. Very excited to chat to you.
Oh, I know. I'm very excited for us to be having a little natter live because I train at Best Pup Academy that Helen runs, and yeah, we do all the hoopy stuff. And as I said, me and Helen train together on a Thursday, but also I train Helen's dog Molly with her flatmate Carly. So we'll discuss that a little bit as well, because I'm sure Carly won't mind us talking about her.
And no. She's very proud of Molly.
You should both be proud of Molly. She's amazing. So Helen, before we get into it too much, who are you? What do you do?
I'm a dog trainer now. I run Best Pup Academy with my colleague Tony Patching, who is a behaviorist. So we kind of bounce off each other in that way. In terms of my background, I started life as a personal trainer. So went from training humans to still training humans, but training humans to train their dogs.
So when you, so you've kind of come from more of a sport background, as in human sport rather than dog sport. You're now involved in dog sport. You do agility with Molly and stuff. But how do you think that kind of having that sport background, that kind of coaching background, has helped you with being a dog trainer?
So much, because actually, like I said, for me, when I'm dealing with pet dogs and pet dog owners, being able to train the person, not the dog, is really important. Mm-hmm. Because they're the ones that have got to go home and live with this dog. You know, they're the ones that need to put into practice what I'm asking them to. And my educational background, I did a degree in sports science, which includes learning theory and behavior. But also then I went on to do a master's in sport and exercise psychology.
Oh, wow. Cool.
And a bunch of the, I'm trying to find the word, outlines, the frameworks that are used in dog behavior come from human behavior.
Yep.
So it gives me that crossover to understand both the dogs and the humans at the same time.
Yeah, yeah. But the thing, because I think one, there's a couple of things I want to pick up on. First of all, learning is learning regardless of species. There are certain things that we know help with learning, you know, reinforcing behavior, all of that kind of stuff. But also it goes kind of across the species. Mm. So we know that if we are giving precise feedback to the learner, they're more likely to understand what they're learning, hence why we use clickers, why we use markers when we're training, rather than waiting for the learner to get something wrong and then punishing them.
You know?
I mean, back, you know, punishment was used a lot in schools with children, and now we're understanding that that's probably not the best way to teach them, you know, using, well, basically physical abuse, because it is abuse, right? Now, sport's quite an interesting one, isn't it? Because there are times where sport hurts.
Yes, very much so. Quite a lot of times, if you're doing it properly.
And trying to explain some of that, look, I know this hurts, but it's going to be really worth it in the end. Like, when you think about various, but we've both played hockey previously, and I'm sure taken a hockey stick to the shin or mouth or whatever.
Yes. You know.
But it's that buzz, isn't it? It's that adrenaline of doing a team sport, working together. I think a lot of people kind of don't understand that you and your dog are a team, right?
100%.
And it's our job as a trainer to be the coach to get the best out of that team.
100%. 100%. So it's for me, it's kind of breaking it down for the human as well, especially when it comes to dog sports, because our body language plays such a big role in how the team works. So if our physical movements aren't precise, it affects the dog. No matter how much you've trained a verbal cue, if you're not physically in the correct position. So I see my job a lot as actually helping the humans understand the body position they should be in and why it works.
Yeah. Because dogs talk and humans talk, but we both talk two different languages. But one thing that all species speak is body language. You know, you get, and sometimes you can only explain it as a gut feeling. But if you see an animal do something and your gut goes, oh, hang on, the animal's probably telling you to back up and go away. If you approach an animal and you think, oh, this is nice and relaxed, chances are the animal is also relaxed. I'm painting a very broad stroke here with the brush, but I'm not trained in cat or, you know, cow or pig. Yet those are all animals I've been around, and I find cats easier to read than I do cows, and cows easier to read than pigs. But a farmer that's working with those animals all the time will be able to read them perfectly because they understand that body language, right?
Yeah, 100%. And one of the things that with pet dogs, and actually it does cross over into my previous life. So for example, when I taught kickboxing, I would pick up on a small element of their technique, but they wouldn't understand they were doing it. So sometimes I had to video people and play it back and sort of precisely pinpoint and go, look, see, you've dropped your hand. And they're like, oh, I didn't even know. Mm-hmm. And it's the same thing. That third person looking in is really important.
Well, so, it's one of the reasons, isn't it, why we try and video each other when we're training, because it's good for you to watch your training. It's good for you to watch your handling, not only to see what the dog's doing, but also to see what you're doing as a handler, because it's hard. Like the other week doing heel work, me discovering that I can't hold a ball in my armpit and move my left arm at the same time. It sounds like the stupidest thing, but like, I was like, what do you mean I have to move my lower arm but keep my upper? Like, just, it was not computing in my brain. My brain was like, yeah, no.
No, it's like, no, that's not happening. And you sometimes...
move your arm or hold the ball. Yeah. Can't do both at once.
And sometimes you're going, right, why can I do something with my right? And then I can't replicate it on the left. You know, it's like, oh, why is there a big difference between the two?
Yeah, and I think as well, like, again, we're saying that because I am right-handed, but we do a lot of dog stuff on the left because, you know, tradition.
Yeah. Heel work, etc.
And, you know, with Dale breaking his arm, I was like, oh, well, that's right, because he's broken his left arm and he's right-handed, so that's okay. And then I was like, oh my God, if I broke my left arm, that'd be a right pain because I do everything with my left arm with the dog. Then I was like, oh no, that would be very annoying. So it is kind of, it's building that muscle memory for people, isn't it? So can we geek out a little minute?
Wait,
I know. I'm putting you on the spot a little bit and I apologize. And I think you know where I'm going to go with this, but can we kind of explain what muscle memory is? Because it's one of those terms that gets thrown around a lot in training. Oh, it's just muscle memory. It's just muscle memory. But what actually is that?
So basically, the easiest way of explaining it is the neural pathway from your brain to your muscle. So the more you practice a certain movement, the more that pathway gets efficient and like channeled. So, but that can have the wrong effect for us, because if we keep doing this same thing, but it's not what we want, you actually lay down the wrong neural pathway.
Mm-hmm.
If that makes sense. So
instead of it being a nice straight path that gets you to the goal, you've actually made a twisty turny path that
But also it will become, so for example, I want to, I don't know, put my thumb down and leave four fingers up, but every time I do it, I do a weird thing with my thumb. That will become the neural pathway that's strongest, so that it will become more and more likely that I'm going to repeat that behavior.
I'm now wondering how many listeners are sitting, if you're driving, don't do it, but are listening and have tried putting their thumbs to their palm whilst leaving their fingers up. I can do it a lot easier on my right hand than my left hand.
Yeah, and that's because you've probably done it more often on your right. But our brains, we have this neuroplasticity. So even if you've trained the wrong movement, it takes longer because you've got to detrain, but you can retrain your body. So a little bit like a shaping for a dog, I would start the retraining process by making closer approximations. You know, rather than continually going for the full movement and getting it wrong every time, I would go, cool, let's just start by dropping the thumb a little bit.
Then lowering that criteria right down, so it's in little tiny sections rather than
exactly what you'd do with a dog.
But I think quite often we don't always think about what the human side of the team is doing, do we? We get so focused on what the dog's doing and what the task is required for the dog.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's tricky because you go, well, hang on a minute, the human, you know, I can do something for the dog. For my example is going to be Hoopers. So obviously that's what I train the most. I was actually training lovely dog yesterday, and she was learning about how to go around a barrel. And the owner asked if I could show her, which is cool. Some people learn better visually. So if someone asks if I can show them, then of course I'll show them. So I showed her with the dog, and the dog was like, oh, cool, we do the thing. And then the owner tried to do it, and the mechanics weren't the same, because obviously I have those neuro pathways of how to send a dog around a barrel. So I actually ended up having to take the dog out of the equation and just get the human to do the movement. And then we added the dog back in. And actually, we did video me doing it before she left, so she could go back and watch the video so that she knew she was getting it right. But instead of me just going, oh, so send your dog around the barrel, use your right arm, right leg, I had to really break it down into your toe, stand with your toes to the barrel, take one step away from the barrel. Your right arm and right leg are going to move forwards to the barrel. As the dog goes round, your right arm and right leg are going to come back to your start position.
Yeah.
Then the dog will be on the left. And it was actually really, really good for me as a trainer to go, right, I've got to really break this down. How do I explain it in almost written terms? You know, if.
Yeah. Almost like bullet points.
Exactly that.
But, you know, for some people, like, depends on the mechanical skill of people. So for someone, I'm one person, I might be able to do that and start to chunk behaviors. So that's where you go from just move your hand to move your hand and leg at the same time. So that would be a chunk of motor skills. But for one person, I might just let them know that start with just the hand movement. Or being able to stay upright while they make the hand movement.
Right. The reason why both me and Helen have laughed is because I'm constantly being moaned at for leaning forwards in heel work, because apparently I can walk leaning forwards. I don't know I do it. But also I used to get moaned at when I rode horses for leaning forwards. So apparently my center of gravity is forwards.
And in agility, all of the time, people want to get lower and help the dog, but it does the opposite. They want to kind of get their hand down and point, and they approach a wing and they lean at it.
Okay.
And what they're really doing is turning their chest to the floor or starting to rotate the chest towards the dog, which makes them go, oh, hello, what do you want?
Yeah.
And turn back to the handler.
It's so interesting, isn't it? How these little subtle movements from our bodies, our dogs read them so well. Because the thing is, as humans in general, we are a little bit arrogant, aren't we? And we do kind of not pay as much attention to the rest of the world as the rest of the world pays to itself, as in nature, because animals are very good at reading body language, environment, all of that kind of stuff. Whereas as people, we've kind of been conditioned to pay less attention, I think.
I'd agree. But also what's the phrase we use in sports psychology? Okay. If I tell you to do something, it's a good idea. If you tell you to do something, it's a great idea.
Yeah.
So we are instinctively, our thought process is really to go with what comes from within.
Yeah.
So it's the same thing. Our attentional focus tends to be quite small.
Yeah.
And that's why we can do things like hyperfocus, which you and I know all about, you know, where we start to read a book and someone could come in and go, do you want a cup of tea? And we would just completely ignore them, not because we were ignoring them, it's just because we didn't hear them.
Yeah.
Because our attentional focus is so narrow. And I find that happens in dog sport as well, where the handler's attentional focus is so narrow because they're almost in a panic. Their arousal state is so high that they can no longer actively really see their dog.
Mm-hmm.
They're not seeing what the dog does in any moment. They're panicking and rushing, and so they can no longer take it. They just physically can't take in any more visual stimuli. They're so focused in their physical stimulus.
Yeah. And it's interesting, isn't it? Because when, like, I know that when I'm competing, the second I'm on that start line, I set him up, I take a breath, I step off him.
Mm-hmm.
Everything else is out. It's just me looking at him getting around a course. Like, and with him, it's getting him to focus on, it's just the course, not the environment around, because, you know, genetics, which is getting better, I have to say. But I think it's very easy for handlers and trainers to say the dog got it wrong, when actually,
the dog did what you asked,
what it believed it was asked to do.
Yeah. I have a principle when I'm teaching my beginner agility handlers. I call them cock-up cookies. If the human cocks up, the dog gets a cookie.
Yeah.
If it wasn't the dog's fault, which, as you say, normally it isn't, they've done what they thought they were asked to do. Unless your name's Molly, and then she's just like, whee! It's so much fun.
Yeah. I'm going. Where are you going, Molly? Fast. Where? She's like, I don't know, but I'm going fast.
Yeah, I run fast. I can't think and run fast.
Like me with the toy. She can't do the fast and the steering. I can't do the holding of the toy and the arm movement.
Like, exactly. It's like patting your head and rubbing your tummy. It's just, your brain can't do two things at once.
Yes, you have to really like focus on it. And that I can actually only do one way as well. I can't do it the other way.
Yeah.
That muscle memory.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And it's about that, you know, the chunking I was talking about. Mm-hmm. So it's like, okay, cool. We almost have to teach one bit. So for example, the ball under your arm, until that is taking up much less of your cognitive range.
Yep.
So that you're, it's so automatic, you don't need to think about it anymore. And then we can add in the movement with it.
Yep. Yep. Until you're proficient in one bit.
Yep.
But do you find it's quite hard sometimes that people try and rush their training?
100%. 100%. I'm constantly telling people not to be greedy.
Yes.
Don't be a greedy trainer. And I had it in personal training as well. People would try and do an exercise that if they didn't have the foundations, wasn't actually doing what it was supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if they weren't engaging the correct muscle because they couldn't,
yeah,
it would not be working the thing that they were supposed to. And they thought it was easier than it really was because they were compensating. And I think they do the same in dog sports and in dog training in general.
Yeah.
You compensate.
And I think as well, you know, because a lot of the time, and, you know, I'll hold my hands up and say I'm guilty for this, because there are behaviours that my dog is proficient in and we are proficient as a team,
mm-hmm.
that's the stuff I tend to show on social media because it looks cool, right?
Yeah.
I've literally sat there and gone, so when this baby dog arrives, I really need to show the process of how I'm teaching it and how I'm training it, because with Dodge, I've got a million and one photos. And yes, there are some videos, but I really wish I'd videoed so much more of his training.
Yeah.
So much more, especially the Hooper stuff and the foundation stuff, because people kind of see him, you know, like I can pretty much, once you're in his circle, I can say to you, oh, do you want to run him around a course? And he'll go to his auntie and he will, I say auntie because there's very few uncles in his circle that would actually want to do Hoopers with him. But I know that he will do a sequence and that kind of helps. The other thing is that quite often we are teaching novice teams on both sides. So you have a novice handler with a novice dog.
Yeah. 100%.
That's really hard.
Really is, because the novice handler is so focused on their dog that it's difficult for them at the same time to focus on them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's that chunking again. It's like they're not proficient enough. And it's what you were saying about taking them aside and going, right, let's take the dog out of the situation. Let's work on your movement.
Yeah.
Especially in agility. In agility, some of the movements we have to do are really quite complicated.
Blinds terrify the shit out of me.
Can you imagine doing a blind with my dog?
No. I feel it should be like law that you should not do blinds with fast dogs because someone's going to die at some point. Like,
yeah.
For those of you that are unaware, a blind is where you basically turn your back on the dog and the dog changes sides, but behind you. So you hope and pray that you get out the way before a dog collides with your legs and takes you out. Or you take the dog out, or you both take each other out. Like, it's terrifying. I do them with Minx because she's tiny and I'm a bit quicker than her. Also, she's very proficient in avoiding my legs and my feet because she's little. Would I do it with Dodge? No, because it would hurt.
No, they terrify me with Molly. I've gotten better. But to put it into context how fast she is, on Sunday at an agility show, she almost took out the judge because the judge wasn't expecting her to come through so fast out the tunnel that she hadn't taken the step forward that she needed to. And so not even halfway around my course, I had the judge basically on her tiptoes doing a limbo backwards, swearing, going, ah, shit. And so I'm laughing as I'm trying to handle Molly for the rest of the course.
I mean, you know, I feel like you should have got extra points for imminent mortal peril. Any agility judges listening, I'm sorry, I don't mean it really, but also like, yeah, that's quite funny. I feel I would also have laughed. This is why when we judge Hoopers, we are out the way, Quite often we're sat in a chair. We are nowhere near where the dogs are going to be running. Agility judges don't have that luxury, unfortunately.
They don't.
But going back to kind of, I know we joke about Molly doing the whole, I'm going fast, this is where I'm going. It's really hard when you are teaching people a new thing with a dog. But when you then add hyper acceleration,
yep,
it makes it even harder. Or the dog suddenly goes, yeah, I know what I'm doing. And they suddenly speed up and the handler is not prepared for the speed that's about to happen.
Yes. Well, I'm aware of that because one of my staffy crosses that I used to have, he would just randomly change speed on a course. He'd be going steady, and then suddenly he'd go, yay, and run off like a loon. And I'm like, I was not prepared. And you didn't know when it was going to happen either. So
joy. So it's almost like he had a NOS button and he like hit the accelerator, hit the NOS, and off he went. And you were
But so therefore it was very difficult to get the timing.
Yeah.
And this is, I think, something that unless your brain can be relaxed and have enough bandwidth in it, the timing is one of the most difficult things. Because if you're not seeing the dog, and you can't actively tell that moment when it's in the position that you need to cue it, you're going to keep getting it wrong.
But even taking that back to the real world, if you like, let's take it away from the sports minute back into the real world. Things like when to recall your dog. That's a really good one, because there are times where if my dogs are like, you know, in what I call in the bubble, admittedly, I don't tend to go off lead at the local park very often because people. But I can kind of, if my dogs are busy sniffing, my sort of rule of thumb is, unless it is a real emergency, like I've suddenly, we're in Surrey, so actually this is a fully expected risk in the summer, I spot an adder, then I need to recall my dogs quickly because that's an emergency. But if they're just kind of sniffing and snuffling along and doing things, I try not to recall them from that because they're just doing dog stuff. But then you get a point where all of a sudden they hear or see something, generally of the furry type. And you literally have a split second, don't you, of are you going to get that recall or are they going to be off and gone? And again, it's not always squirrels near us. Quite often it's deer. And that can be a, oh no. Because you have that split second, don't you, where you've got to get the word out, get the cue out. And again, it's about building that muscle memory for you and the dog, because the dog needs to understand what the cue means.
Yeah.
You need to make sure you've got the right cue out your mouth, because let's face it, when you're panicking, sometimes all sorts of things come out your mouth.
Yeah.
You know?
Absolutely.
There's a reason why my emergency U-turn is a swear word, because that's the most likely thing to come out my mouth at that point, right? And I think it can be hard for owners to read their dogs and know when they're about to. I remember I used to walk a lovely, lovely whippet called Ellie. She was a sweetheart. And her ears would go up.
Yeah.
If you didn't catch her before they crossed, she was gone.
Yeah.
So you literally had that little kind of ears went up to the very top. And then as they started to cross, you had to quickly get her, because if you didn't get her before the ears crossed, that was it. Laser was locked and she was fired. And you were like, oh, okay.
Cool. No point now.
How do you kind of help your client? How do you sort of coach your people into what to see from the dog, how to read the dog? Because a lot of the time, us people are just oblivious, right?
So what I try and do is I watch the dog myself as that outside third person view. it's much easier for me to go, okay, cool. When you make this movement, your dog does this. Mm-hmm. And one of the most common things is, so at a recall and or at the end of a walk, whatever, a person reaches out to put their hand on the dog's collar and the dog backs away. And sometimes it's quite subtle,
mm-hmm.
you know? So a lot of the times people haven't actually noticed that their dog's not very keen on having their neck felt.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a really common one. I might go, right, have you noticed this? And then they try it again and they go, oh yeah. I'm like, all right, so maybe let's change your hand approach to underneath the chin.
Yeah.
You know, or I give them the collar touch game to play to really make the collar being felt a good thing. You know, so that kind of thing, really, often it's about me stepping back and watching
mm-hmm.
and then reflecting to the owners.
Yeah.
What I've seen.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Because it's sometimes hard for the human and the human side of the team, because it can be really frustrating, can't it?
Yes.
It can be so irritating when yeah. in your brain you are doing all the things right and you're giving this dog all the food and they live in a nice house and you're taking them for the walks and, you know...
Yeah.
I'm going to quote a post I saw earlier that they've got, you know, private schooling, private healthcare. They've got, I was like, that is a brilliant way to put it, actually. Like,
yeah, that is.
But our dogs don't know that. They don't see that. All they know is that you are the human that provides the good stuff.
Yeah, hopefully. Yeah.
Hopefully the good stuff, you know.
Yeah.
What's your kind of advice if you've got owners that are starting to feel a bit frustrated, or even if you're starting to feel a bit of a breakdown in the team? Because I think that's quite a common one, isn't it? Is that people think they're being a team, but actually they're not.
Yeah. So one of the things I'd go back to would be for them to really think if they understand what their dog loves in life. And how they can use the things that don't involve them to increase their relationship.
Yeah.
So if you've got a beagle who cannot take its nose off a sniff, right? Okay, how do we get involved in the sniff?
Mm-hmm.
How do we become part of that? I describe it to a lot, particularly in my recall sessions, as I describe it to my clients as a seesaw.
Mm-hmm.
Of motivation.
No. Right.
Okay. I'm talking Labradors particularly here. If you've got playing with another dog
mm-hmm.
versus a little bit of cheese, everyone would expect with a Labrador that cheese would win.
Mm-hmm.
But normally it doesn't.
Yeah.
And if it does, it's normally cool. Thanks for the snack. I'm back off again.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Go back and play.
Yep.
So I'm going to people, okay, what are they getting out of that play that they're not getting out of a quick snack? For me, it's probably to do with the adrenaline
mm-hmm.
and the interaction. So I'm like, cool, how can we switch that seesaw so they're more likely to come back to us?
Yeah.
And it might be, right, okay, we've got to, for one dog, it might be we've got to up the value of the food.
Yeah.
Not a dry biscuit. It's got to become a bit of cheese or sausage, and it's got to be more than just one. It's got to be a jackpot. For another dog, it might be a game of tug.
Yeah.
So I often do that in my recall sessions. I get people to watch other dogs recalling, and we will try it with different rewards.
Yeah.
And I get them to feed back to me and go, oh, cool. Did you see any difference in the speed or the enthusiasm of the recall, or what happened at the end of it? Did the dog stick with the owner, or did it go, thank you, I'm off?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
yeah. I think as well, like when we look at kind of the recall and the reinforcement, we also need to think, because people will be like, oh yeah, they're really foodie. But, you know, have they just eaten? I mean, hopefully if your dog's just eaten, you've waited at least an hour till you're exercising them, because you shouldn't be running your dog on a full stomach. Yeah. But health and safety risk assessment. especially, you can tell I've got shepherds and chihuahuas, can't you? Dogs that are prone to getting bloat, do not exercise after they've eaten. But it can be that, you know, in the house, I can quite easily use, you know, kibble, sort of bonios, like dry stuff for training. But actually, when we're out in the world, we do need to up that reinforcement. I was training a hound this week, and his owner came with roast lamb. I was like, yes, all of that. Because sight hound, slightly different motivations. You know, they are sprinters, not endurance sport dogs. So making sure that we had the really, really good reinforcement so that he was like, yeah, okay, I can keep working, rather than just going, yeah, no, I'm just going to chill out over here, thanks.
Yeah. Everything else is much more interesting.
And I think also sometimes we do have to be mindful with how much reinforcement we are using, toy or food, because also having tiny dogs, I know that there is a treat capacity.
Mm-hmm. And
reached capacity, they go, oh, do you know what? Actually,
it's not that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, absolutely. But something and this is geeky, so
do it.
I need to geek out for a second. I talk to a lot of my clients between the difference between a reward and a reinforcer. So a reward is something that's nice to have. A reward can be a reinforcer, but it doesn't have to be. So a reinforcer, we only know about after the fact. So its technical definition is something that increases the chance of that behavior repeating. So if you're giving your dog a dry bit of kibble every time it comes back to you in the park, but it doesn't change the number of times your dog comes back to you in the park, it is not a reinforcer.
Or the proficiency in which the dog comes back to you.
Yeah. If they will only then come back to you for that, if there's nothing else about.
Mm-hmm.
That is not a reinforcer. If it doesn't change the behavior, it's just a reward.
Nice. I like that. I should have got everyone's little brains going. Ah.
Yeah. So this is, and I think this is where obviously you and I come from a much more positive side of training.
Mm-hmm.
You know, neither of us are going to use adversives on our dogs.
No, I mean, that's not to say we don't tell our dogs no and that there are
rules. Absolutely.
You know,
but there's a...
the laws of the world of the world and the house and how we live. Yeah. But, yeah, I'm not going to use tools that cause pain to train a dog.
Absolutely.
By commas.
You know, with Molly, I had to use very low-level adversives. In other words, for her, an aversive was being separated from me, even if that's for a couple of minutes, being the other side of the door. Especially when I very first got her, she didn't like it. But when I first got her, she had a number of behavioural problems, but one of them was an inability to control her arousal levels. So any sort of excitement, she'd end up jumping up and using me as a tug toy.
And teeth on...
Teeth on skin.
No.
Absolutely. So I had to teach her that the moment teeth went on skin, she was either in her crate or in a different room.
Yeah, there's a consequence for the action. It's not about... And this is the thing where I think we have to be very mindful when we talk about, you know, reward and punishment, because actually reinforcement and punishment would be a better way of saying it.
It is, because actually, again, the technical term of punishment is that it's something that decreases the chance of a behaviour.
Reduces behaviour, yeah.
So actually, when I say punishment, I don't mean smacking around the head.
And this is the thing, isn't it? Again, we have been kind of conditioned that in society, punishment means something bad has happened.
Yes.
It doesn't have to be a horrible thing. It can literally be you've asked the dog to go to their bed, or they've been popped in a crate, or you just haven't given them the cookie that time.
Yeah.
You know, how often when, if we've cued something that, yes, the dog understands and the dog gets it wrong, we'll go, oh, and I know reward markers are one of those things, aren't they, that get very, it's a heated debate amongst trainers. Now, for me personally, with Munchkin and with Dodge, I use no reward markers.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really use them with Minx, because if you tell Minx that something is incorrect, she goes, well, fuck you then, and leaves the training area.
Again, this is,
right,
to be honest, and that is that, that's what, to me, that that's where the art of training is, as opposed to the science of it.
Yeah.
So, and you would do the same thing with human clients. Right, okay, what's working for this person won't work for another.
Yeah.
Back to my PT days, my natural style of training is lighthearted and fun.
Mm-hmm.
My housemate will tell you, because she, the reason we met in the first place was I was her trainer. We were going to talk about her in a minute in terms of hoopers. So for everyone listening, she's disabled. She has cerebral palsy, which affects her movement. And when I was her personal trainer, if anyone had been looking in from the side, they thought I was abusing the disabled lady. Because we were laughing, we were joking. You know, if she got stuck in a hip flexor stretch, the only way I could really get her out of it was just to push her over slightly onto the mats, right? So it, to other people, it looked awful. But to me and her, it was just us having banter.
Yeah.
But I could do that with her because of her and her personality and what works for her.
And the relationship you two have as well. And relationship is a huge thing as well.
Yeah. Rapport building is massive in any training relationship, whether that's with a human or whether that's with a dog.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got to, as a trainer, you've got to take your cue off your client.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly what you were saying with Minx. Molly, again, she works off the no reward marker because to her that makes it clear.
Yes, it's information. Oh, okay, that didn't work. Let me try something else.
Yeah.
It's the same, and Dodge is the same as well. But again, I think that's maybe because as well, my skills as a teacher have improved. You know, me saying, right, mm-hmm. do this, do that, do the other, because I was, you know, fortunate to have this drivey bull breed thing that needed the correct information. So when I got the worky shepherd thing, I was like, oh, okay, cool. I know how to deal with this.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying they're exactly the same, but there are definite similarities in training those two dogs. Whereas I find it sometimes harder when there's a dog that's maybe a bit less motivated, a bit less drivey.
Yeah.
You know, that's a bit more kind of, oh, so it's almost like, and this is a huge kind of Disneyfication, what's in it for me?
Yeah.
And that is Minx all day long. Minx, do you know how long it took me to fade a lure with that dog? Because she was like, unless I can see the goods, I ain't working. Even in, like, you know, doing hoopers with her, she's the only dog I run with, because if she's burning calories, I also have to burn calories. This is how this works in her world. Like, on a Thursday, she literally comes out, doesn't she? Says hello, demands treats off everyone, and then goes back to the van.
Yeah.
Like, that's just her existence now, because she's old and she can do what she wants. But as a puppy, I wasn't taught how to fade a lure very well.
Yeah.
I was kind of told, well, you use the lure, then you don't use the lure. And the second I went, okay, well, we don't use the lure, she went,
no.
Right? She literally was like, mm-mm. No, this is not how we do things. If you want me to do stupid tricks for you, I want to see the goods.
Yep. Absolutely. And you, this is the art of it. You've got to go, right, cool. This is this dog. This is its personality.
Mm-hmm.
This is the other dog.
Yeah.
You know, I've gone from my bully breeds, who were, I mean, I was so lucky with my two. They were just the loveliest to train.
Mm-hmm.
Super easygoing, enough drive, but and enough enthusiasm, but not over the top.
Yeah.
Only thing I had issue with was Honey and her desire for food.
Mm-hmm.
That was the one occasion there was a, they'd put the burger van right by the ring at agility. She went round the corner nearest, went straight off to the burger van, looked up, and then just came back and continued the course.
But obviously at that point you've been eliminated because the dog's left the ring and it's very annoying.
Absolutely. But that was after a long time of me working with her to make agility so much, because she did love agility. You know, she thought it was the best. And we did some hoopers with her.
Yeah.
And she, when she had to retire from agility early, and she loved it.
Yeah.
Really did. But for her, I knew the thing that made her really shine was trick training.
Yep.
Moment she knew we were doing tricks, she just, that was her reinforcement. She loved doing them. And then I went from those two to Molly, who
I I'm sorry, I have to giggle because I sort of feel like the same thing happened, like a similar story. You know, I had Munch and Chica that were my sweet baby angels and they were the best girls and they worked and they did all the stuff, and then Dodge arrived.
Yeah. And
why did we switch to herding breed?
I have no idea, mate. But the way I described Molly is like a Ferrari.
Yes, I concur.
She is completely, I mean, she wants to work. For her, working is its own reinforcement. I had a client the other day, jealous that she, when she's off lead, she doesn't go far from me. You know, if I'm still talking to a person, she'll just be lying down, facing me, staring at me.
But-
and I'm like, yeah, but that's mostly her breed. I can't take credit for that.
Yeah,
that's not something I've trained in her, except for making sure we have a relationship.
Mm-hmm.
It's the only thing I've had to do with her in terms of her recall.
But she's a very intense dog. Her energy is just like, she is like a little freaking pot of chilies, isn't she? And I'm not talking like your nice little like, oh, we'll add a bit of chili. I mean, we are talking like Reaper chili. She is, she can be spicy, right?
Yeah, the ones you have to handle with gloves.
Yes, yes. And the ones that like, basically you have to sign a waiver before you're going to eat them. Like, she's not just a little habanero.
She is not. So I had to change everything that I did as my own training.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to do things extremely different with her when she first arrived, with all her issues with around arousal, etc.
Just going back with her arousal, was it almost kind of a redirection in that?
Yes.
There was just all this energy and she didn't know where to put it. So it just went teeth to skin because she didn't know what else.
100%.
Mm-hmm.
100%. She just didn't know what to do with the energy.
Yeah.
And it could spiral from nowhere almost.
Yeah.
Initially, because I used to, I did clicker training a lot, obviously, when I was doing tricks with my first two. I couldn't use a clicker with her. Just the sound of the clicker was enough to make her spiral.
Mm-hmm.
I had to take it out and I had to remove marker words and I had to just sit at home doing like, sit and down, but in a very quiet, relaxed fashion, and do 5 repetitions and then stop.
Yep.
Because any more than that, and she'd get frustrated. Not frustrated, it was a redirection of arousal.
Yeah. And that's the thing when we talk about, because frustration's become one of those words that it's got a bit icky, hasn't it, in dog training? Mm. Because, oh, well, we can't let dogs get frustrated. But the world is frustrating.
Yeah.
It's very difficult, isn't it? So it's about us teaching our dogs what is an appropriate way to express their frustration. So rather than her going, oh my God, bang, and grabbing your arm, it was, right, okay, what can we teach her instead?
Yeah, 100%. And with her, it was almost just teaching her the relaxation, the off switch.
Yeah.
I mean, some, and again, things like
off switch that doesn't come as standard in all models.
No, it certainly doesn't. I was like, I was checking all over her body going, it must be here somewhere.
Hang on. Well, I didn't realize this was an optional extra. I would have paid the extra money to have the off switch installed, please. Thanks.
You know, and again, there are things within dog training that are very controversial. But I think it comes under, again, that understanding of the dog that's in front of you.
Yes.
So things like crating a dog to get it to rest.
Yep.
Yes, I understand that there'll be dogs where I'm like, that's not appropriate because that crating creates other problems.
Yeah.
But for Molly, it was the, when she was younger, when she was 7 to 12 months, when I first got her.
So in that lovely teenage arsehole stage.
Yeah, absolutely. Perfect time to get a dog that's already got a few issues.
Ironically known as the rehoming stage, which was actually why you got her, right?
So I was very lucky. She didn't come from any bad situation. She came from a very loving home. Very loving. But her colliness was a lot. You know, she's extra. She's not just your normal collie. She's on the higher end drive.
Yeah.
So, but for her, the crate was the only place she would switch off because she had no stimulation. So I would use a crate a couple of times a day and cover it. And that would give me an hour's break from her.
But also it would give her an hour's break of downtime because the thing is, when you're so, so fizzy all the time, it's exhausting. And then when you're exhausted, the frustration gets more and it just becomes this vicious circle, doesn't it? Of just overtired anger.
Tired puppy is an angry puppy.
Yes. Overtired anger is not the one.
It's that. You know, and again, it was that not knowing how to deal with her tiredness. So she would just get, you know, more angsty. Like, and anything she found that got her attention, no matter what that attention was like, she would keep doing it.
Yeah.
So if that was, you know, trying to literally anything she found, put it in her mouth. Scrabbling at the bottom of my sofas. Things like that, you know, just, and like, she was like, oh no, I get attention when I do these things. So again, the crate became, you know, both places. And I think people don't understand that it can be both.
Mm-hmm.
So the way I worked things with her was if I said crate time, I would put her in there for her rest, but I would put her in there with a treat or something nice. If it was
like a long lasting chew or
exactly. So whereas if she was going in as we stated before, a punishment, but from a technical term of punishment, I would say uh-oh, which is her no reward marker, and I would put her in the crate, and there would be nothing with her. So she understood the difference in the context.
Yeah, because I think people do worry, don't they, about it can be very easy to make the crate a punishing area.
Yeah.
It can be very easy for that to happen. And I mean, for me personally, the way I did it with Dodge, we planned on having crate and pen, but actually he learned to relax in the pen quite quickly. So we dropped the crate out and had the pen, mainly because he had such big batty ears that the size crate we actually needed, we got less room to have a pen that was open air and he didn't keep banging his ears on than it did to have the crate out. So you know, we had the pen with him, but with imminent puppy, my plan at the moment is pen for daytime and crate for sleeping. So if I need to, you know, leave her unattended, she'll go in the pen where there'll be a bed area, there'll be access to, you know, like shoes and toys and that kind of thing. But the crate will be the sleeping area at bedtime.
Yeah. To this day, Molly takes herself to her crate at night.
Yeah. Minx puts herself in her crate at night and it's like, okay, I'm going to bed up. Quite often she's like, are you lot still up? It's bedtime.
Exactly. Even my high drive collie, I have the same thing. As a youngster, I was very determined that she would not learn that when I got her up in the morning, that meant we were going straight out. Because of her ability to pattern.
Yeah.
So from day one, I would get her out of bed, give her a cuddle, and then I would go off and get my coffee, and we wouldn't do anything for at least 45 minutes to an hour.
As in, like, any training or anything like that?
Yeah, any walk, any...
I'm just clarifying that. You let her out for a wee, but, like, then...
No,
you...
she doesn't even need a wee at that. Like, obviously, if she has to go out, I let her out. Okay. But she's so comfortable with that routine now that she gets out. She gives me cuddles and then takes herself off to the other sofa, curls up in a little ball like a fox cub, and knows that I go get my coffee at this point. But I had to teach her that.
Yeah.
You know, if I had gone, oh, I've got to get her out quickly in the morning to burn off some energy, that's how she would still be now.
And this is one of the things, isn't it? Because, like, again, with me saying letting them out to go to the toilet, like, toileting in the morning is a non-event. It's literally I come down, I open the door, go be clean.
Yeah.
Like, that is it. I've heard so many stories of people that are like, oh my God, the puppy wants to play at 3 a.m. And then you find out it's because the puppies needed to go to the toilet at 3 a.m.
Yeah. Perfect.
Puppies need to pee at stupid o'clock in the morning because they have tiny bladders. But then the person's not just gone, oh, good puppy, go back to sleep. They've then interacted with them and the puppy's gone, oh, bring a toy. And they've gone, oh, they've bought me a toy. And then they've played. And then they make 3 a.m. playtime and you're like, you realise the puppy has just trained you.
Yeah.
You play at 3 a.m. Like,
oh, our dogs train us all the time.
So the plan was, because Minx has been sleeping up in the bedroom since we lost the other two girls. And I was like, right, with the puppy coming, we could probably do with everyone being back downstairs because the puppy will be in her crate and Dodge will be downstairs. And Minx has literally gone, if I don't sleep upstairs, I get to go to the toilet whenever I wish. And I'm like, really? Second she's back upstairs, she's holding her bladder all night, no problem.
Yep.
Now, that's where it's very easy to fall into that kind of Disneyfication. I know that's not the correct word, but I can't pronounce the correct word, so I'm calling it Disneyfication, of a protest we.
Yeah.
No.
No.
Well, I can see why people go, oh, well, that was deliberate. I think with Minx, she's gone in when she's upstairs, she might wake up and go, oh, I might need a wee. Oh, but everyone's snuggly and calm, so I'll go back to sleep. Whereas when she's downstairs unattended, she goes, oh, I think I need a wee. Oh, yeah, I'm going to go for a wee then.
Yeah, because she's got more space to sort of get up and move around. There's a mat
by the back door that's perfectly appropriate to pee on in a chihuahua's world, okay?
Yeah. And now she's done it a few times. Habitual.
Right. And I'm not going to lie. All of my dogs have been so easy to house train except chihuahuas. And I think part of the reason they were so tricky to train was because I did use puppy pads for a long time.
Mm.
And I wish I hadn't. But hindsight, right?
Yeah, too right.
Differently, like, you know, it's tricky. But also, the more we know, and we do better. When we know...
Absolutely.
Like, would you say that... I asked Diane this exact question about Louis. If you had known the ride Molly was going to take you on,
mm-hmm.
if you took her on, would you have said yes?
Now, yes.
No. If you were told right at the start, you are going to have these years of this dog biting at you, it's going to be more intense than you've ever known, would you have taken her on, or would you have been like, actually, I don't know.
I would have definitely thought harder about it.
Okay.
Sure.
Now, but I think, you've been on the journey and you're like coming through the other side. And yes, she's still got her little quirks and glitches. They all do.
I think what I knowing now what her, what that journey has done is make me such a better trainer.
Yes. Yes.
And I don't think I can regret that.
Yeah.
For all the difficult days when I was tired or stressed or...
For the literal blood, sweat and tears.
Literally. I have a blog on my website about just that, going, do you think you want a working breed?
Yeah.
Be prepared. And then the subtitles are blood, sweat, tears.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I have people come in to me with their first dog being a working cocker or a collie or, God forbid, a Mallee, you know.
Careful, careful.
But for a first dog.
Yes.
But yeah, these things come and they come in. And there are times when it works out absolutely fine.
Yeah.
I think it is easy to generalize, but I do think the ones that work out, as trainers, we don't see so much.
Yeah.
So I think we are predisposed to only, especially in the pet dog world, see those with problems.
Yeah, massively.
Or the owners who are having problems.
So if you were... Because let's face it, I know that there's going to be listeners out there that have the knob dogs, have the dogs with the big emotions, have the dogs that aren't easy. And there are days where you literally question your life choices and go, oh my God. What would kind of be your little sort of, what's your take on your ride? And obviously everyone's ride is different, you know, and there are going to be circumstances where, you know, last year we attempted to rehome a dog into our house. Unfortunately, it didn't work because the dog was disabled. And the way our house is and the dogs we have in this house, it was not the correct environment for 100%. Her. And also, it wasn't fair on the current dogs in the house to have a dog with the disability she had to try and make it work, because it was going to be very difficult. Now, it absolutely broke my heart to say no, but I knew at no point was it going to work. And I was really fortunate that I obviously had a lot of support, a lot of trainers, a lot of friends that were like, look, you're making the right choice. But I also... I know there were people, oh, she just gave up. Oh, she didn't try hard enough.
You know, they don't know. You know, and I think there is a lot of stigma around rehoming. And the more I see of the trials and tribulations, the less I think it's always about, like, I think there are times like yourself when it's at absolutely the right thing. Like, and so often it comes from a place of love.
Yeah.
Knowing that you cannot give the dog what it needs. Molly's first owners, they 100% made the right decision for her and for them. And they miss her. They love her still to this day. Do you know what I mean? They will be the first people to text me on her birthday. It's so lovely. They get to watch her journey. Yeah. But everything they did for her was out of love.
Yeah.
including passing her on.
Yeah, including rehab. Well, same with Dodge's people, you know, they went out and bought their first dog, and Dodge is not a first dog dog. He's
no, he is not.
You know, I'm not going to lie. There's been times where I've questioned whether I've had the skills with him, you know, and it has been emotional. But I think it's one of those things, especially with social media. This is one of the times where social media is like the devil and the angel, because you can get the support, but also you get the judgment. And yep. I think as trainers, we put a lot of pressure on ourselves with our own dogs.
Yeah, all the time.
It's very easy to be comparing. And the thing is, it's nuts to compare, because we are all different people. Our dogs are all different characters.
Yeah.
Those combinations make it completely different as well. So even if you have even dogs from the same litter, the fact that they've got their own characters and then they go to different people and they do different things, and some might have children in the house, some might live with other dogs, some might just live with, you know, two lovely ladies together, some might be in a big family. You know, it's there's so many variables to what makes a team that sometimes it's not always going to work, is it?
No. Exactly. And the other thing that the more and more I see of people, and I'm talking pet dogs here as well as sport dogs, in fact, quite a lot of pet dogs, when people say, it's always the owner, drives me mad, right? Molly doesn't care about other dogs unless they're coming up into her face. And then she has very clear feelings about the situation.
Yeah.
Right. And that started after her first season. And it's a mixture of things for her. She had no traumatic experience with dogs.
Yeah.
I haven't allowed the behavior. But, you know, between us, we're working through it.
Yeah.
Just yesterday, she had another dog come to the outside of our training field. Mm-hmm. And she was up at the fence and they had a nose-to-nose greeting. And this is a dog, actually, that she knew as a puppy. And he was young at the time, but sometimes he was a bit too much for her.
Yeah.
And they had a nose-to-nose greeting through the fence and nothing happened.
Cool.
And it was more me that panicked than her, because I was like, oh, I didn't see him coming, you know. But, you know, she just sniffed him and then came away when I called. So it was a good experience. But, yeah, the whole it's always the owner thing drives me crazy. Drives me absolutely crazy, because I see so many pet dog owners tired, emotional, upset. They're doing their best. They are working. They're coming and getting training. They're, you know, and they get upset by other people's opinions.
Mm-hmm.
And then you'll have people out and about who say, oh, train your dog. And you're like, well, what do you think I'm doing?
Right.
Training is not like a magic wand. You go, oh, and now you are trained.
Can you imagine how much money we could charge if we could literally wave a wand and it was done?
Do you know, I used to say that as a PT. I was like, if I could take other people's limbs and train them for them and give them back, I would make an absolute fortune.
Because, and this again is where there's another crossover, is it? Because unless you're putting in the reps, you're not going to reap the rewards, because you're not putting the reps in.
And one of my favorite quotes, I get this from Corinne Rend. She always asks people, what does practice make?
Progress.
No, permanent.
Ah, nice. Okay. Yeah, I always say practice makes progress.
Yeah.
Practice makes permanent. Because again, we've had it drilled into us, haven't we? Practice makes perfect. There is not perfect in dog.
And also, back to what I said about the neural pathways, practicing the wrong thing makes that permanent too.
Yes. Yes.
Only perfect practice makes perfect. And there's, like you say, there's no such thing.
Yeah.
I do try my best when I put up training videos with Molly to not edit them.
Yeah.
And not take out the bad reps.
Yeah.
Because I'm like, the bad reps are generally, I've missed my timing or...
But also, if you're not getting things wrong, you don't have anything to build and improve on.
Yeah.
If you, and I'm going to phrase this very carefully, if you are perceiving what you are doing as correct,
yeah,
you don't see a need to change it. And notice I say you perceive, because actually what you may be doing might not be the correct thing, but you have perceived it as, well, this is the correct thing to do.
Yeah. And it's so easy to get in a rut of what we're doing.
Yeah.
And you end up banging your head against a wall and you're like, why isn't this working? Why isn't this working? And it's very difficult as a human to try something else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know?
Condition of insanity, isn't it?
Yes.
Just trying the same thing again and again and again, expecting something different to happen. But we do it all the time.
Oh, yeah. It's no different to us going, oh, new year, I'm going to get fit. And you make the same resolutions every year.
I'm not going to
lie. Never happen.
Doing that once I hit 40. I was like, yeah, no, I'm just living with a bit more of a belly than I used to have, whatever.
But yeah, do you know what I mean? Like, people make the same resolutions every year, but they don't change how they action on it.
Yes. Yeah, it's, well, it is the ongoing joke, isn't it? That gym membership goes up massively by January. The gym is full. February, there's less. By June, there's no fucker in the gym because everyone's outside because it's sunny. Like, yeah. Everyone's back in the beer garden with their mates at the park.
I can perfectly attest to it doesn't take to June.
Am I being nice there? Is it literally?
You're being very kind. By February, everything is back to normal.
Oh, wow. Okay. Because this is the other thing that people don't realise. It takes a lot of time to make something habit. It takes
6 months.
But also that means it takes just as long to break a habit.
Longer.
Ex-smoker here.
Yeah.
it was a journey giving up smoking. But, you know, I'm now, oh God, nine years smoke-free now.
Excellent.
But I didn't just become smoke-free overnight. I actually came up with a plan, and, you know, I vaped for a bit and I did all this stuff. But again, it's thinking, right, so how can we change the behaviour? Because especially when dogs have been practicing those behaviours and it has become a habit, it has become permanent.
Yeah.
You then have to go, right, so let's go back to Molly with the, I get over aroused, I get overexcited, I don't know what to do, I'm going to grab something with my mouth. Happens to be the human. What were your kind of steps working her through that? Because you can't just say to the dog, no, don't do that. You have to say, no, do this instead.
Yeah. So that is where it became this ritual. I was like, anytime teeth are on skin,
mm-hmm.
in your crate you go. And I,
that was a consequence. Yeah.
Yeah. And I had to be black and white.
Yeah.
And it became, even if it was an accidental teeth on skin, same consequence. There couldn't be a gray zone where I accept it for a couple of minutes. I could, like, and some days it would be, she goes in a crate. I think she's calmed down. She comes back out and she starts up again, back in a crate. She went, like, I had to commit to being consistent.
Yes.
And that's hard.
Yeah.
And I'm, you know,
consistency is one of the biggest things in training, isn't it? Whether it's people's dog sport, even just living in the world, you need consistency and you need to know what the rules of the games are. Yeah. And if the rules keep changing, it's not fair on the dog.
No, they can't understand, because, you know, when we're talking to owners,
mm-hmm.
they can get some nuance
mm-hmm.
to varying degrees. But like you say, we do not speak the same language as our dogs. So we cannot explain to them nuance.
Yeah.
I do always tell people that dogs understand context.
Yeah.
So if you want them on the sofa at your house, but not at other people's, that's doable.
Yeah.
But what is more difficult, I think, is, okay, sometimes you're allowed on the sofa at home, sometimes you're not.
Yeah.
You know, and in that case, to
a
me...
A little solution for that, because I had a similar situation previously where furniture was moved and some of the sofas were okay for dogs to be on and some weren't. So yeah. We have blankets. If there was a blanket on the sofa,
yeah.
It was allowed. If there yeah. was no blanket on the sofa, it wasn't allowed.
Absolutely.
Again, that gave them a visual and a tactical cue
yeah.
of, yeah, this is cool, or actually, no.
No. Yeah, 100%. So it's kind of like those context cues.
Yes.
That's the only thing we can really do to help our dogs with nuance.
Mm-hmm.
I do the same with lead walking. I encourage people to get, for general lead walking, a harness, because I like harnesses. Preferably one with plenty of shoulder movement.
Yep.
That doesn't have that bar straight across the chest. Mm-hmm. Collapses the shoulders. They make me squirm.
Also, really easy for the dogs to escape out of.
Absolutely. That happened at one of my classes the other day.
I see it. The dog literally does what we nickname the Superman, where they stick their legs up above their head and slide out the harness. And you're like, and now they're loose. Marvellous. Great.
That's it. They're gone.
Yeah.
So I actually like the one, the harnesses with a D-ring on the front and the back.
Mm-hmm.
So that I can use a double-ended lead. And my Molly knows that if the clip is just on the back, she can have, I call it leisure mode. She mm-hmm. can wander around, she can sniff. The only rules of that is she's not allowed to drag me down the road.
Yeah, she did try and test those rules with me the other day, actually. She was like, does this human have the same rules? Yes, this human has the same rules.
Absolutely. Also, you're very lucky, she's often very cautious or anxious about other people holding the lead.
Mm-hmm.
I fully appreciate it.
I'm in the circle. I feel
very... Yeah. Even if they're stood right next to me, if I hand the lead over, she can get quite anxious.
Yeah.
But that's just her, one of her foibles. So back of the harness, she's freedom, mm-hmm. relatively, obviously, because she's still on lead. If I clip it on the front and the back, she knows that's work mode.
Mm-hmm.
She knows that I want her back being near my side, mm-hmm. you know, and that's the kind of walking we might do if we're going around a garden centre or around a pet shop.
It's more polite. It's not formal heel work, but she's not sniffing everything she wishes straight away. You will leisurely proceed to the sniff rather than just going to the sniff.
Yeah. And this is what I need when I need you to be working a little bit with me.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, we're not doing fancy heel work.
Yeah.
So it will be, you know, if we're going around the garden centre, and I'll be like, right, and now we're going to practice our sit and stay, and we're going to practice, you know, down. And I just want that extra little bit of communication with her.
Yeah.
I want her to be that little bit more with me.
Yeah.
Otherwise, she can have a sniffari. She can go and do what she needs to do and be a dog.
Yeah.
The work mode is much more for we need to get somewhere.
Yeah.
And you need to be with me a little bit more. But the context change is where she feels the lead.
Yes. Yeah, that makes sense. The other thing I do want to just chat a little bit about Molly with her hoopers, because Molly trains with me, but you're not the primary handler.
No, not in Hoopers.
No, not in Hoopies. So you do the agility with her and do the fancy flicky toe heel work with her and all that stuff. But your lovely flatmate Carly is the primary handler in the Hoopies. Now,
she is.
This has been really good for me as a trainer because some weeks Carly shows up with her sticks.
Yeah.
And I have to kind of position her where I need her, but she can move around a bit. But the last couple of training sessions, because the ground has been so wet and slippery and awful, I've done my health and safety risk assessment and gone, please bring the wheelchair.
Yeah.
Now, actually, I feel that it works better with Carly in the chair than it does with her on the sticks.
Yeah.
For a couple of reasons. First of all, I know that Carly is more stable because she sat in a chair, so therefore she can't fall at any point. But it was really interesting. A few weeks ago, before the weather turned, we had 6 weeks off training because the field was basically a swamp and it was a disaster. But before the swamp happened, it was getting a bit wet and a bit soft, and Molly was doing this beautiful outrun down this line. And Carly slightly adjusted her weight because her balance was going. And Molly came off the line, ran straight to her and went, oh my God, are you all right?
Yeah. She's so in tune with Carly. It's amazing.
Yes. Now, the other thing that happened was then Molly ran over to me and jumped up at me. And I was like, okay, why are you jumping? And I was like, hey, don't be jumping up, madam. Like thinking that she was sassy. What I didn't realize is she was trying to tell me that Carly was actually feeling lightheaded, but hadn't told me.
Yeah.
And that actually Carly might need an adult. Now, the fact that Molly picked me as the adult is equally amazing and terrifying.
Yeah.
But I feel her in her choice of what was in the field available to her at the time. That was like her only choice.
She was like, Auntie Carrie will do.
Auntie Carrie, if you could just be an adult for like a minute, that'd be great. So can we just talk a little bit about what kind of happened that day? Because I didn't know Molly did this, but also you didn't train her to do this. So what's the sitch? What does Molly do with Carly that's like magical? Because it fucking is.
Yeah. It's amazing. I am like, so when I first got her, even if you sneezed or coughed, she would, but when I sneezed, she would literally jump into my arms. Most bizarre, right? She doesn't do that anymore, luckily.
But, yeah, hay fever season is a bitch. You just
just constantly with my dog in my arms.
Yeah.
But yeah, so what happened is Carly has asthma. And as a result, along COVID, she has a lung condition called, a heart condition, sorry, called POTS. So initially, when we first moved into this house, her asthma was really playing up. And any time Carly was starting to have an asthma attack, she would just run over to Carly.
Mm-hmm.
Like, because she's really sensitive about breathing. She hears weird breathing on the telly. She's like, panic, panic. She doesn't like it. So, and it just became a thing whereby, like, we could be playing downstairs. Carly would be starting an asthma attack upstairs. She would break off and run up to see her. And
that's just crazy because you wouldn't, I mean, first of all, it shows how amazing their hearing is, but also like she's in the middle of a game. She's not paying any attention to what Carly's doing. Whoa, hang on a minute.
Yeah.
She's like Lassie.
She is. Well, that's what we describe it as. Like Jimmy's fallen down the well moment.
I was going to say, instead of children falling down the well, it's Carly's asthma's bad. But you know, it's.
Because if I'm downstairs and her asthma's bad, she'd often then run up to her, run down to me, in a panic. When I went upstairs, she would relax because she was like, oh, it's a cool, mama knows.
Yeah.
Mama knows now. So, But the pots thing, when that started, it very much
random became... noises, by the way, are Molly amusing herself while we're podcasting.
This is her trying to tell me very distinctly that her water bowl is empty.
She has had a drink. She's not thirsty.
She has.
Being dramatic.
But she's currently going, my water bowl is empty. That was another thing she taught herself when she was little. Her water bowl would empty and she'd just pick it up and bring it to me and be like, this is empty, Mum.
Excuse me, staff. Staff.
Please.
Literally, like, yeah, she is staffing you, isn't she?
While we're chatting, I'm going to fill her water bowl so she doesn't have a strop.
Right, so Molly's water is now full again. So we're saved.
We're comfortable now.
Hydrated.
She's very demanding. But yeah, with the Carly with her pots, one day we noticed that she was doing this panicky thing when Carly went to stand up. And she went from on the floor, she jumped up onto the sofa, got underneath her, and kind of almost pushed her back down. Because she's normally so gentle with Carly. Yes. So gentle with her, has been from day one. It's like she understands that she's disabled. Mm-hmm. And Carly then sat down and she was like, I don't understand what this behavior is. It was different. And then she went, oh, there it is. And she went all lightheaded and she was like, okay, cool. And this has just become a thing. After a couple of times of her doing it, she just said to me one day, she went, go get my oxygen monitor. And she took it and her blood oxygen was low.
Mm-hmm.
And it really, she's just taught herself how to do it. It's unbelievable. Her instinct for it is, she often tells Carly a good 30 seconds or a minute or so before it happens.
Yeah, and from my point of view, because Carly was walking across the field on her stick, so I was like, okay, let me help you, because Carly's perfectly capable of getting to the car, but I was like, right, let me help you get to this car and sit down, because Molly is very upset right now. And then literally we got to the car and Carly went, yep, no, she was right.
Yeah, always.
I remember
right.
Mesh to you going, oh my God, this has happened.
Yeah.
I drive home. And I know Carly's an adult and can tell me this, but I'm not going to lie, part of me was very panicked.
But it's that thing of, getting, like you say, one of the reasons Carly trained with me as a personal trainer was because when she first came to me and explained what she needed and what she wanted to get out of it.
Mm-hmm.
I said, I've not worked with someone with cerebral palsy before, but you tell me as much as you can. I will do some research and we will work this out together.
Yep.
Because everybody's disability is different.
Yep.
Even within cerebral palsy, there's a massive range.
Yep.
Massive range of how it affects people. So I was like, you feed back to me. And I try to take that with some of my dog training clients. I'm like, okay, tell me what you're struggling with understanding.
Mm-hmm.
How can I help you get this? And sometimes it can be as simple as a catchy little phrase. I came out with something one day at an agility class, and it seems to have helped the whole class. I just said, tits to target, and they all laughed, but because it was funny, it stuck in their heads. So they're like, oh, I get it now.
I mean, don't want to upset any of the men folk, especially if they're on the heavier side, but it makes sense.
Still makes sense. If they really want to be sensitive about it, pecs to target, but that doesn't work as well.
Target, there we go. Okay. If we're being anatomically correct.
Yeah.
But it does just amaze me, how Molly is very, not very different, but she is definitely different with how she is with you to how she is with Carly. Because I obviously see both sides of it. I see you turning up training with her, and I see her turning up for training with Carly. And she does know that Carly moves differently and has different and has different capabilities from what you do. But also, like, sometimes if there's been things that we've got a little bit stuck on Hoopers, I've been like, right, Helen, how do we teach Molly to do this? Then I've got you to do it with her standing up. Then you do it in a chair and then go, right, Carly, I need you to do this. Because it's different. It's really, it's pushed me as a trainer.
Absolutely.
You train someone that does have physical differences. And actually, I'm loving it.
Yeah. It's such a, isn't it a thrill when you have to think outside the box?
Yes. And when it works, it is like a little, like, it is a pure freaking magic moment where you
did it. Yeah, it's like work. It's almost like working with that really difficult dog and they have a breakthrough.
Yes. Dodge and Molly.
Yeah, Dodge and Molly. Well,
yes, we can both. Yeah.
Or the moment that I had this one dog ages ago that came to my a different agility class at a club I used to teach at. And he didn't care about treats at all.
Mm-hmm.
Toys, not interested. Mm-hmm. Only vaguely interested in his human.
Okay, cool.
So we had a lot of trouble.
Yeah.
Getting him in. But one day, when we first went over the dog walk with him, he loved it. So I was like, cool. We can use that.
Mm-hmm.
If you go over a jump, you get to do the dog walk. You go through a tunnel, you get to do the dog walk.
Bit of pre-mac. Nice.
Yeah. And honestly, he became a real, like, but that moment that I first saw him light up about training was amazing. But the reason it was so amazing was because we'd had trouble.
Yeah.
So sometimes the more difficult... Mm-hmm. The challenge.
Yes, Molly, we concur. The easy path is not always the most fun.
No. I'm looking at you, dog.
He's like, whatever. For the listeners, Molly has literally decided that we have podcasted for long enough and now she really needs to go and do some work and we need to stop talking. So, Helen, before Molly gets far too demanding, people want to know... what you're up to, where you're training, just let people know and how they can get a hold of you and stuff.
Yeah, no, I'm based in Dorking in Surrey. So it's a beautiful part of the world.
Very nice part of the world.
Yeah, and we train at a private 6-acre field. We're very lucky. It's stunning.
Yes, it is. I like it. It's a fun place in the world.
We love it. I would move into the field if I could. Just me and a tent in the corner, I'd be happy. But yeah, so my academy is Best Pup Academy. Bestpupacademy.com is our website, and that's got all of our classes. So we do everything from puppy, adolescence, and then we do man trailing, agility, hoopers, some scent work, some tricks. And I have a thing called the After School Club. And every week we do something different, which is amazing. So I get to geek out.
Yeah.
Like, we'll do confidence one week. We'll do problem solving another. It's just loads of fun. Nice. And we're always trying to add more things to our offering.
Cool. Excellent. So, guys, as always, stay safe. Be kind, wash your hands thoroughly, keep your dogs on lead around livestock, and don't let them lick toads. Take care, guys. Bye. Guys, I just wanted to ask you a real quick favor. If you could rate, review, and subscribe to the podcast, it's going to help other people find me and listen to what I'm doing here at Canine Hoopers World. We're now on all the socials. So we have the Instagram, we have the Facebook, and we are officially on the TikTok at Canine Hoopers World. And remember to check out our website, www.caninehoopersworld.com, where you can find out information on in-person courses, online courses. And if you're doing Hoopers with your dog, you can also join in with our online achievement awards. These are open to any person, any dog, anywhere in the world to come and test your skills and get yourself a cool ribbon.